We're continuing our walk through the lyrics of the Psalms. In this episode, we're going to look at a short psalm, Psalm 11. And so as we get into it, if you haven't already, we would love for you to subscribe. And when you subscribe, be sure to hit the little notifications bell icon. That lets YouTube know to tell you whenever we have new content here on the channel. And one of the reasons that's important is because we frequently do live streams and different giveaways. Don't trust the algorithm to just pop it up on your feed whenever you hop on YouTube. Hit the notifications icon, and that way you won't miss any of the stuff that we have going on. All right, let's look at Psalm 11. This is a short one, so I'm going to read it as always in the old NIV. And then we're going to look at the Hebrew text and the Greek Septuagint as well and look at some interesting things that pop up in that. For the director of music of David, in the Lord I take refuge. How then can you say to me, flee like a bird to your mountain? For look, the wicked bend their bows. They set their arrows against the strings to shoot from the shadows at the upright in heart. When the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord is on his holy throne. He observes the sons of men. His eyes examine them. The Lord examines the righteous, but the wicked and those who love violence, his soul hates. On the wicked he will rain fiery coals and burning sulfur. A scorching wind will be their lot. For the Lord is righteous. He loves justice. Upright men will see his face. Now this is Psalm 11 in the Hebrew Bible. In the Septuagint, this is Psalm 10, because remember what we call Psalms 9 and 10 were only one psalm in the Septuagint. So Septuagint readers, people in Greek Orthodox traditions, any tradition that uses the Septuagint as their primary Old Testament text, this is going to be Psalm 10. Hebrew Bible readers, this is Psalm 11. And it just has a short title line for Natseach, which we always transliterate. We don't know if it's a musical term, if it's a specific person who was in charge of performing the psalms. I just don't know, so I leave it untranslated. But it is Le David, for, to, or by David. Based on the context, I think it's pretty likely that this is David writing it. And so it opens, in Yahweh Chasiti, I take refuge, I find refuge. And then the psalmist asks the question, how will you say, literally, Le Nafshi, to my soul? You might say, to me. And so he's asking, how can you say this to me? And this is what's being said to him. Flee or flutter. There's a little bit of a kathiv kare issue here. The kathiv is nudu and the kare is nudi. It's just a minor issue. It doesn't really affect the meaning of what's going on here, but this verb to flee. So literally flee, it's a command. Flee your mountain, and the your in here, this ending M, this is actually a plural. Y'all's mountain, we might say. Bird. So poetry doesn't follow standard grammar. Different translations have handled it differently. Let's take a look. JPS, the old one. Flee thou to your mountain, ye birds. The Tanakh, the updated. Take to the hills like a bird. LEB, flee to your mountain like a bird. King James, flee as a bird to your mountain. Septuagint, flee to the mountains as a sparrow. Now, if this is David and his people loyal to him, and they're being told by others, hey, you need to get out of here, like Saul's going to seek your life. The plural could be explained by this is not just saying to David, hey, go flee, but hey, you all, you, David, and your men that are loyal to you, you need to get to your mountain. And that could be his stronghold in the wilderness. But this image of a bird flying away to a mountain, it's an image that does have a similar usage elsewhere in the stories about David. For instance, when Saul was hunting David, and this is 1 Samuel 26, verse 18, then he said, why is my Lord pursuing after his servant? For what have I done, and what evil is in my hand? And then verse 20, he says, and so then do not let my blood fall to the ground away from the presence of Yahweh, for the king of Israel has gone out to seek, said the king of Israel, Saul, you, Saul, king of Israel, has gone out to seek a single flea. In other words, David's being like, you're the king of Israel. I'm this nobody. You've come out to seek a single flea as one hunts a partridge in the mountains. So the idea of mountains would be the place where one would go because that's where a bird would fly away to safety. And so hunting birds in the mountains is an image found in the Davidic literature. And so that may be behind the imagery that's being used in this psalm. So why is someone telling his soul to flee to the mountain, bird, or flee to the mountain like a bird? Well, verse 2, for behold, wicked ones tread the bow. they establish their arrows upon the bowstring. This together is an image of how you would string a bow. You would literally step on the bow to bend it. So one foot steps while the other bends. If you've ever had to string a bow, you know, we used to have to do this in PE class during archery session. You would hold it and you would step on it to put the bend in it. And then you could knock the bowstring. And then when you put your arrow on it, you would position your arrow. Like you'd knock your arrow onto the string, lay on top, and then you're ready to shoot your bow. So this is just a poetic image. A lot of English translations, they don't have you step on the bow. They have something like you make your bow ready. NIV has they bend their bows. But it's just an interesting, I think it's an interesting Hebrew idiom. To tread the bow is to step on the bow so that you can string it, so that you can shoot arrows. And that's the third line of verse 2. To shoot through the darkness at the upright of heart. Liroth comes from the verb yara, and yara means to cast or to throw, but in the context of bows and arrows, we would say to shoot. Bomo ofel, and this can either be in or through. Bomo can mean in or it can mean through. Ofel means darkness or gloom. So some translations have said to shoot from the shadows. I think NIV has from the shadows. LEB has from the darkness. JPS, they may shoot in the darkness. Tanakh goes with from the shadows. The Septuagint has on a moonless night. Eugene Peterson translated the Message as under cover of darkness. So the wicked, Harashaim, and we've seen the wicked before. This is a very frequent term throughout the Psalms, including the Psalms that we've looked at in this series. The wicked are taking aim at, literally in this case, the Yisraelev, literally upright of heart. And this is worth mentioning because it'll come up a lot in the Old Testament, but this word lev, heart, it doesn't mean heart in the way that modern English usage understands the word heart. It's the center of who you are. It's your inward self. It's not heart as in your feelings as opposed to your mind. That distinction pretty much doesn't exist in Old Testament Hebrew. Heart and mind are the same. In fact, some places lev gets translated as mind when it's talking about decision making. So we just want to be careful because this is a common thing in, especially in evangelical Christendom, is to separate heart from mind. One is the thing that you think with and one is the thing that you feel with. So you got to guard against your heart, the feelings, and be, you know, use your brain to make decisions. That is not really a Hebrew Bible concept. That's a later philosophical breakdown of humanity, anthropology, read into the scriptures. So the upright of heart just means someone whose inner life is rightly oriented. And they're the contrast to harashaim, the wicked. So all that to say, this person, whoever it is telling David or the psalmist, telling their soul, you know, speaking to their soul, speaking to them, flee to the mountain, bird, or flee to the mountain like a bird. The wicked, they're getting ready to shoot their arrows, and they do it in the darkness against the upright of heart. Like not a frontal daylight attack. This is a shadowy, either a sneak attack, an ambush, a shooting from cover of darkness. This is not just a one-on-one battle, not what we would call a fair fight. So just like an archer getting ready to hunt for a bird, he's saying, hey, fly away. They're taking aim. And if the foundations are demolished, what can a righteous one do? Now, this may be talking about the foundations, meaning like the household, like your household. And if this is to David and he's being told to flee, hey, if Saul destroys your house, you know, destroys your family, your foundation, your family standing, what can you do? Like, you got to get out of here. Other interpreters have suggested that the foundations is talking about like society. This is a bad situation. The kingdom is deteriorating. The king is crazy. I mean, he's going to seek the life of his son-in-law, his most prized warrior. So it's the foundations of the kingdom. And if they're shaken, if they're demolished, if they're overthrown, then what can the righteous do? Or it could just be like a proverbial saying, just like flee to the mountain like a bird. That's a proverbial image. This could also be just like a proverb. If the foundations are demolished, what can the righteous do? In other words, if the foundations are done, the house is going to fall. So I don't think we can press it too far. But David's response in this is to talk about foundations that can't be shaken, to compare what he's being told is his situation with what he knows is God's situation. And he says, verse 4, Yahweh in his holy temple. Well, we have to supply the verb is to make it make sense in English, but literally Yahweh in his holy temple, Yahweh on his heavenly throne, his eyes see or behold or gaze. There are a lot of words for to see or to look at. This one we're going to see is an important word. It's going to appear later in the psalm. So just keep an eye on this word, Yechazu. Yahweh is in his holy temple and he's watching. And so this is a similar attitude being expressed by David. Yahweh is in his holy temple. Yahweh is on his heavenly throne. Now, this is not the temple in Jerusalem, because David didn't build the temple. His son Solomon would be the one to build the temple. So maybe David is referring to the tabernacle at Shiloh and the mercy seat, the Ark of the Covenant that God is enthroned upon. Or, and I think this is more likely, he's referring to God in heaven, his heavenly throne, not his earthly throne, not the Ark of the Covenant with the cherubim, and that's the throne where he dwells in Shiloh, but what that is a replica or a representation of, which is God enthroned in heaven. So either way, this is what David rests in and responds to the urging to flee by noting. So his eyes behold, and then in Hebrew parallelism, his eyelids examine. You know, some translations don't even have eyelids. They, like the NRSV says, his eyes behold, his gaze examines humankind. ESV has eyelids. RSV has eyelids. HCSB and CSB both say his eyes watch, he examines everyone. CSB altered that to his gaze examines everyone. But literally it's his eyelids examine. And Spurgeon said, as men, when intently and narrowly inspecting some very minute object, almost close their eyelids to exclude every other object, so will the Lord look all men through and through. God sees each man as much and as perfectly as if there were no other creature in the universe. He sees us always. He never removes his eye from us. He sees us entirely, reading the recesses of the soul as readily as the glancing of the eye. And I think that's a great way to kind of bring out the sense of what the psalmist is talking about. His eyes behold, his eyelids examine the sons of humanity, B'nai Adam. So righteous, wicked, everything. In other words, God's in his holy temple. He's on his heavenly throne. His eyes behold, his eyelids examine all of it. God doesn't miss any of this, and he's in control. So verse 4 is just a beautiful picture of what it's like to acknowledge and trust in God's sovereignty. And his eyelids don't just behold B'nai Adam in a general sense. He goes on to unpack it in verse 5. It says, Yahweh will examine righteous and wicked. Yivchan, and this is the same word. You can see it if you know a little bit of Hebrew. You can see that they examine, meaning his eyes, he examines, meaning Yahweh. And so what he's examining, the B'nai Adam, the sons of humanity, are both the tzaddik, the righteous, v'rasha, and the wicked. And then the next line of verse 5, there's a difference between the Hebrew and the Septuagint. The Hebrew says, and the one v'ochev chamas, the one loving violence, hates his soul. That's literally what it says in Hebrew. The one loving violence hates his soul. The question is, who is the one doing the hating? Most translations have something like the one loving violence, his soul, and I've capitalized his here because they would say it refers to Yahweh. The one who's examining is the one who is hating. So Yahweh is hating the soul, and you can take it as it's Yahweh. Yahweh's soul, Yahweh's life, Yahweh is going to be the one who is hating the ones who are loving Hamas. Violence. However, that's not how the Septuagint translates it. The Septuagint translates nafsho, his soul, with tain eaftu tsukain, his own soul. Verse 5 in the Septuagint says, the Lord examines well the righteous one and the ungodly one, but the one who loves injustice hates his own soul. So the Septuagint sidesteps the whole question of how can you have God hating people, and they take it as, no, that's not what the text is saying. The text is saying the one who loves injustice by his loving of injustice is hating his own soul. So it takes the he in his soul as not referring to God, but as referring to the soul of the Ohev Hamas, the one loving violence. So the different translations handle it differently, even rearranging some of the syntax. The NIV that we read at the beginning said, "The Lord examines the righteous." So some translations break this verse here and they read it this way, "Yahweh the righteous examines," period, or comma, "and the wicked and the one loving violence his soul hates." So some translations, you'll read it and it'll seem as if God hates the ones who are rasha, who are wicked and loving violence. And that's grammatically possible, but I think because of the parallelism here, especially with hating and loving, I think it should be broken here. But the Septuagint rendering, "the one loving violence hates his own soul," I think that's also plausible as well. So I don't take a hard stance on which of these is the correct reading. I think both make sense, and I think you could make sense of both. And as usual, when there's genuine ambiguity in the text, I think it might be intentional. I think both of these things could be true, because if you love the destruction of other people, well, they are the image of God. They are B'nai Adam, sons of humanity. You are the image of God. You are the sons of humanity. So in a way, you're hating your own self. But I also think you can make the case that God does hate those who love the destruction of others. I think that it's okay to say, yeah, there are things that God hates. And in Scripture, God is really insistent that he hates the violence and the destruction of the innocent. And so people that are loving that, I don't see a contradiction between God being able to hate in that sense, even while John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only son." I think because God loves people, he does hate the evil that they do. And that can poetically be described as hating evildoers or hating ones who love evil. So I think only if you press the language for extreme literalism in a philosophical way, do you then get into some of these conundrums that people like to throw out, like, oh, how can God hate anyone? I don't think that's how poetry works. I think it's, again, these are prayers, these are songs, and these are telling us something about human emotion reacting to wickedness. So I just say, when it comes to the Psalms, just be careful how far you try to press them into the realm of philosophical, theological axioms. Then in verse 6, not only does God see, examine, and hate what he sees, but verse 6 is proclaiming the psalmist's hope that God's going to do something about it. So he says, "He will rain down upon the wicked." And there are three things that he's going to rain down. And there's question. This is involves a text critical issue. The Hebrew text says he will rain down upon the wicked. Pachim means snares or traps. And some translations say he will rain down snares. And then the next phrase, fire and brimstone. But that's not what you see in a lot of English translations. So here's the word, pachim, and Lexham English, "He will rain coals on the wicked, burning sulfur." King James, "Upon the wicked he shall rain snares," there's snares, "fire and brimstone." JPS, which follows the Hebrew text usually, "He will cause to rain coals," and the Tanakh, "He will rain down upon the wicked blazing coals and sulfur." So they're taking pachim, and they're translating as coals, and then Aish is modifying the type of coals, coals of fire, or blazing coals. And all the other modern translations, coals, 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 coals. And the Septuagint, that there's the word, snares. It doesn't mean coals. And this may be hard to see on your screen because I'm just showing you my screen, but in Logos Bible software, which is what's on the screen right now, it's saying that this word pachim comes from pach, a trapping net. It's a noun for like a net that you would trap something in. But if you look down here at the very bottom of the screen, when I hover over pachim, you see down there, it says noun, common, masculine, plural, absolute, coals. So where is coals coming from? That's the question. Pachim, pach. The lexicon say it means traps. The Septuagint clearly uses pagdias, traps. So where are all these translations getting coals from? Well, this is a fun textual critical discussion. Does the concept of God raining down traps make sense? Maybe, but you don't normally rain down traps. And that doesn't really fit with fire and brimstone. Coals fits with fire and brimstone. And the word for coals is not pach, but pecham. Pecham is the word for coal, and the plural would be pachameh. So if this originally got confused, if the Masoretes pointed this wrongly, and they read pecham or pachameh as pachim, then coals becomes snares very easily. All you have to do is just switch these two letters, or if this yod was like a blemish or a spot or a speck on a manuscript, and it was supposed to say pacham, and it got read as pachim, then that explains where snares comes from. So this is a really interesting thing. I think you could make sense of either meaning again, but I think this is a text critical issue going on. Now, we have a section in our course here at Disciple Dojo, Bible for the Rest of Us. The session is called Mistaken Manuscripts, and we talk all about text criticism, how it works, and we even give some Old Testament text critical examples. And you can read more about this if you're using the Net Bible. I just put up the Net Notes here. Note 26 in the Net Bible is a text critical note, and it talks about how the Masoretic text reads traps, fire, and brimstone. And then it says, you know, the noun, pachim, should be amended to pachmeh. And it gives other examples of pecham and how it's used in this sense. So I just wanted to take a few minutes because that's kind of an aside, but it's an interesting one. This is a great example of what text critics have to do, and they have to look at old, dusty manuscripts. And when you look at an old Hebrew manuscript and the size that it's written in, and try to imagine, like especially the Dead Sea Scrolls will give you an idea of trying to decipher the difference between, and especially there are no vowels. Remember, vowels were all added later. So is this pachim? Is it pachem? So this is just a cool verse that brings up issues of Hebrew Old Testament text criticism. But regardless, back to the subject, like now that we've looked at what the text possibly might be saying, what's it actually meaning? And it's saying, he will rain down upon wicked ones fire and brimstone and raging wind the portion of their cup. This could also be translated as scorching wind. Literally, Zil Afoth is ragings. It's a plural. But if it's talking about wind in the Middle East, when you think of a raging wind, some translations have like raging wind, like a whirlwind. King James just has horrible tempest. The Septuagint has wind of a storm. And most of the other translations have scorching wind, which contextually makes sense. I mean, in the ancient Near East, scorching wind is an actual thing. Whereas here in the south of the United States, we're more used to like a whirlwind, a blowing wind, even a hurricane. So context would have to determine whether this should be raging wind or whirlwind or storm. But regardless, it's being paired with raining down coals of fire and brimstone. So cataclysmic events is the image that's being used. And so God will rain down upon the wicked these things, coals, fire, brimstone, and a raging wind, a scorching wind, will be the portion of their cup. And this word kos, cup, you can think of it like a koozie is like, you know, you put that in and then you can drink. So that's how I remember it. Kos, Hebrew word for cup. It's kind of like the English word koozie. Mnemonic devices don't have to be super accurate. You just need to remember kos is cup. But this idea of a kos, this is seen elsewhere throughout the Hebrew Bible. Make this a little bigger so you can see. Here are some other verses that explain this idiom. We have our verse, Psalm 16:5. Yahweh is the portion, which is my share and my cup. So your cup, your portion, it's like what you get. We might say your reward or your comeuppance, your recompense. Psalm 75:8, very similar image. There is a cup in the hand of Yahweh with wine that foams, fully mixed, and he pours out from this. Surely all the wicked of the land will quaff it down to its dregs. So the cup that you drink, you're taking it on yourself. Jeremiah 25, for thus saith Yahweh, the God of Israel to me, take this cup of the wine of wrath from my hand, and you must give it to all the nations to whom I am sending you to drink. So the nations drinking the cup of God's wrath is an image of the judgment that they're going to experience. Jeremiah 51, Babylon was a cup of gold in the hand of Yahweh, making drunk all the earth. The nations drank of her wine, therefore the nations acted like madmen. This image is picked up in Revelation, the image of the woman riding on the beast and Babylon, the mother of prostitutes. All of that is coming from the prophetic imagery of cup of judgment being a poetic Hebrew expression. Ezekiel 23, extended parable, very explicit, one of the most X-rated passages in the Bible, uses the image of the cup frequently. I will give her cup into your hand. You will drink the deep and wide cup of your sister. You will be as laughter and as a scorn. The cup holds so much. You'll be filled with drunkenness and sorrow, for a cup of horror and desolation is the cup of your sister Samaria. And so this also explains New Testament concepts, this image of the cup. Like when the disciples were asking Jesus to sit at his right hand in Matthew 20, 22, Jesus answered and said, "You don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink?" And of course, they said to him, "Oh yeah, we're able." You know, he's not talking about any specific cup. He's saying, are you able to endure what I'm about to endure, which is the cross? In Gethsemane, what does he pray? "Father, if it's at all possible, let this cup pass from me." So all of that to say, this is one of the earlier instances of this image, and it'll appear more in the Psalms, it'll appear in the prophets, it'll even appear in the New Testament, and it'll appear in Revelation. So it's helpful to see it early on. When it comes to the wicked, the ones loving violence, the Rashaim, God is going to judge, and the judgment of God is going to be upon them, and it's described as raining down fire and brimstone, and a raging or a scorching wind is going to be the portion of their cup. And interestingly, in this context of judgment, wind, the Hebrew word for wind is varuach. Ruach is also the word for spirit. And we know that the Spirit of God is what brings about some of the judgments, because the psalm ends this way: "For righteous is Yahweh, tzedakoth ahev." Righteous ones he loves, in contrast to the ones loving violence, who Yahweh's soul is hating. Righteous ones, or this could even be righteous deeds. This could either be righteous ones, or it could be righteous deeds or righteousnesses, you might say. Ahev, he loves. The psalm ends with the upright, Yashar, they will, and there's that verb again. Remember I said, remember Yechazu? There it is. They will look, gaze, behold, panemo, his face. So Yahweh looked upon, he sees all, and therefore, when all is said and done, the upright will see his face. And I love that that's how this psalm ends. The you know, safety, protection, vindication, that may be what happens, or we may suffer. But ultimately, in the end, what the psalmist is kind of clinging to is the upright will behold his face, will look upon the face of God. Remember, one of the things in scripture is, you know, nobody can see the face of God and live because of his overwhelming holiness. But when all is said and done, at some point, there will come a time when the upright will be able to look upon his face. And that will come as the flip side of his judgment upon the wicked and the lovers of violence. But for those who are upright, the righteous ones, his judgment is what we long for and when we'll be able to look upon his face. And in his commentary, Derek Kidner's commentary, a little short little commentary on the Psalms, talking about God being refuge, he says, "God as refuge may be sought from motives that are all too self-regarding." In other words, some people can seek God as refuge, which is how this psalm begins, "In Yahweh I take refuge." People can seek refuge for all kinds of motives, but to behold his face is a goal in which only love has any interest. And it's the difference between seeking God for what he can give versus how this psalm ends, seeking God for who he is. If everything we know as good and beautiful and true is only so to the degree to which it conforms to who he is, his nature, then of course that is the ultimate thing that we all want, is to be able to see his face, the beatific vision. You know, book of Revelation ends with there being no temple anymore, because there is now no longer any need for any mediation between God and the B'nai Adam. So this is a short little psalm, but there's a lot in it. And again, if you're just reading Psalms or any passage of scripture and you're only reading from your favorite translation, you miss a lot of this stuff. So if you aren't able to read Hebrew or the Greek of the Septuagint, that's okay. Just read multiple translations. I mean, there's any number of online free Bible resources where you can read and compare multiple versions. So do that. And Psalms like this, short little Psalms like this, take them and compare them, read them carefully, you know, slow down as you read through the text, go word by word. You find some interesting stuff. And so hopefully this video helps you see that in a very short 7-verse Psalm. But that's all for now. Stay tuned as we continue to walk through the lyrics of the Psalms. If you enjoy these type of teaching videos, check out the playlists here on the channel. We have so much content. Most people just associate Disciple Dojo with the guy who interviews scholars and reviews study Bibles. And that is a big part of what we do, but an even bigger and more important part of what we do are our biblical teaching videos. So check those out. Just click the playlist button here on the channel. Subscribe if you haven't already. That really, really helps us out. And when you do, make sure you enable notifications. Just stay tuned for more cool stuff here at Disciple Dojo. And that'll do it for now. Take care. And in the meantime, as always, keep training.